Mondays, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, in Studio B at Revolution.radio.
Oscar's freeze. That's your cerebral cortex looking for an answer it doesn't have.
See? Even your brain knows you're screwed.
Your gut is filling with adrenaline right now. Whether you know it or not, your heart's beating fast. It's getting a little harder to breathe. Your neurobiological system is telling it to run, but your knees are too weak to move.
Fear is not real. The only place that fear can exist is in our thoughts of the future. It is a product of our imagination, causing us to fear things that do not at present and may not ever exist. That is near insanity. Do not misunderstand me. Danger is very real, but fear is a choice. We are all telling ourselves a story.
You're listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. 100% listener-supported radio. Reporting the danger. Unafraid. Right here, where information never sleeps. Revolution. Revolution. Radio!
I think of you as been an inspiration in my radio career.
You must be some kind of a kook.
Thank you.
It's hard out of here for a pimp.
All right, listen up, y'all.
A bunch of a-holes.
Where are you going to go? Where are you going to run? Where are you going to hide?
Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention, please?
Your systems are all blocked.
Hashtag confused, dude.
What kind of feeling? I'm high on the leaving. That you're in love with me.
I'm not good enough for life.
Central 403 Mountain 303 West Coast 603 East Coast. Good evening, Iceland. Happy Tuesday, Australia.
Whoa!
What a expletive week! I literally hate moving bed. We are not broadcasting live from Mario Land 3. We are still broadcasting same location as last. Why? Because I kindly told my general, I'll go and arrange the HVAC guy, so I don't get charged the additional 20%. Well, you know what? I should have just paid it. Because, shit. This dude is rough. Got mini splits and installed heat pump. Just hacked the shit out of the wall. Wanted his remaining balance, and I said, well, no, because he got some stuff he haven't done yet. Asked him if he planned to go by and test the system for AC, if you need to add any more Freon, and said, I guess maybe tomorrow. He lost one of the remotes, never failed to provide me the receipt, so I was unable to apply for the rebate, mind you. It expired the first of this month, and I've asked him twice. Claims I owe him a bit of money, but my reply is no. The things you claimed that you were going to do and the things that you didn't do, I think what I paid you already covers services. So you want to file a lien, go ahead. You'll then have to wait till I sell the property to get your money. Look, I don't mean to be that guy who played hardball, but seriously, man, you try to help out somebody starting up their business, but you just can't be a pleb or a plebe. Anyway, welcome, my friends, to the award-winning but yet to be nominated This, That, and the Other, heard every Monday and Thursday here on Revolution Radio. Now, I hope this Thursday will be the inaugural first show. My fear is that things will not be done up there, which is really going to piss me off. So hopefully a week from today is the inaugural episode. Hopefully a week from today will be the first ever broadcast from Mario Land number 3, because I've had 3 homes built. Hopefully on September 26th. That's when I hope it happens. But you never know. You never know. These sons of bitches just, you know, do what they do. And I should have looked into this guy a little more. Gosh, just a scathing review. You can't just take one review, and I thought it was just me, but yeah, this dude is just stealing the language from my electrician. Just rough. He just comes in, hacks holes, doesn't pay attention to detail, really doesn't care. Almost like, some young 14-year-old or 15 or 16-year-old, some high school kid on prom night experiencing sex for the first time, just not knowing what to do, and just, you calm down, buddy. Just running at 90 miles an hour, talking to himself. And I get some people work that way, but I mean, my thing is, look, man, you got to pay attention to detail. This is your trade. You got to take pride in your work. And if you're just hacking holes in the side of the wall and things are sitting off center, and then your reply is, well, I can't do anything about it now. Well, that's when somebody doesn't get paid. You can bitch and moan all you want, but yeah, just unbelievable. Can you tell I'm slightly irritated by this? Just slightly? Slightly irritated. Let me think. Let's see. Tonight's big show. Jer Bear may or may not be joining us. I got no idea. Apparently, he called me this morning at 8:18. Then sent me a message over Skype at around. Gosh, let me look at this. Sent me a message around 1:22 local time. I'm sorry, 1:49 a.m. What did he send me? He sent me something about, you know, George Knapp, the paranormal dude, and apparently David Politis. Now, this was on September 16th. Bigfoot, the evidence, best of Coast to Coast AM archive shows. We don't care. Yeah, no, I'm sorry. Just because Native Americans, First Nations people all think that Bigfoot is real, doesn't mean anything. All it means is this, is that somebody saw something, somebody heard something, somebody took a cast of a footprint. All it means is somebody heard something, somebody saw something, somebody took a cast of a footprint, and they claim, you know, hypothesis that this is a footprint or a howl or a Bigfoot sighting, right? Until you are able to capture a Bigfoot and test whether or not the howl is the howl, the footprint is the footprint, or what you saw is what you saw, it means absolutely nothing to me, right? I mean, look, at one point, people were scared by thunder because, you know, science. At one point, people didn't know what the wind was, you know, science. At one point, people thought, no. Little things in your body, a virus, no. Anyway, let's get on with it. Dateline. Marginal revolution, small steps towards a better world. Link in the chat room. The Little Scandinavian Prison Project, Dateline September 15th, 2022. The Scandinavian Prison Project seeks to empirically assess what happens when certain practices and principles from Scandinavian corrections are implemented in an American prison system. First of all, we got a problem. You can't compare a Scandinavian prison system to the U.S. prison system. The project focuses on ongoing collaboration between the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections, the PADOC, the Norwegian Correctional Services, the Swedish Prison and Probation Services, and the Danish Prison and Probation Services. The Little Scandinavian Unit differs from the regular conditions of confinement at SCI, Chester, in many important respects, with single cells, custom furniture, a communal kitchen, redesigned common areas, and an outdoor green space. The unit looks unlike any other. Moreover, the officers in the project have, in addition to traveling to Scandinavia to work alongside peer mentors, received training in conflict resolution, suicide prevention, and other relevant skills. This uniquely low ratio of trained staff to incarcerated men is intended to facilitate positive interactions and encourage meaningful communication between the people living and working on the unit. Importantly, we choose to use a lottery as opposed to more common and to some more intuitive approach of only allowing the most motivated or best behaved incarcerated people to move to the unit for two main reasons. First, from an ethical perspective, we believe it is more fair and transparent to the incarcerated men to allow all, irrespective of their past behavior or current standing with staff or management, an opportunity to take part in new, potentially beneficial programs in the prison if they wish to do so. Well, I got a problem with that. In a Minnesota-based prison, during intake, they mistakenly put somebody who was in for some traffic violation with an alleged murderer. Guess what happened? The dude with the traffic violation was murdered in the cell. I'm sorry, but if you're on administration segregation, or what's known as lockdown, or the hole, or solitary confinement, you're most likely not going to play nice with others. If you look at, I mean, the picture comes from a different set, but look, I'm sorry. When you commit a crime, here's my question. What benefit are people going to have to not go to prison if, my gosh, my chance of getting stuck in this place might be pretty good? Secondly, using a lottery means that we can meaningfully compare the groups of men housed at Little Scandinavia to those in the general population, having two groups that are as similar as possible with the exception of their conditions in confinement. It is important when seeking to develop evidence on direct impact of the unit on both in-prison and out-of-prison outcomes. Okay, here's the other question. Who ends up paying for this stuff? Ah, the great taxpayers of your state. But you know what? Most taxpayers don't give two shites about prison reform. I don't know what percentage of what percentage of what percentage from your state tax dollars go to fund any prison within the state you live. But I can tell you right now, midterm elections are coming up, right? No one's talking about prison reform. Do you want to know why? Because nobody cares about prison reform. It's not a wedge issue. It means absolutely nothing. Nobody cares about it. Nobody cares about when incarcerated folks end up being released and dealing with felon, not felon friendly this, not felon friendly that. Nobody cares. And if they do care, they're just trying to win points with their constituents. Oh, yes, it'll be prison reform. Reform. We need to institute laws that new rules and policies that benefit people leaving institutions. Oh, okay. All right, I got a solution. You just take things west of Minot, North Dakota, you wall it off, and that's where you send everybody. Every person who has a life sentence, you just parachute them in there, airdrop food, survival of the fittest, right? They'll figure it out. I mean, is that kind of a apathetic thing to say? Of course it is, right? Let's allow child rapists to have these nice, cozy cells. You know what? I'm sorry. You're not going to have a communal kitchen. Someone's not going to let you use the stove. And I guarantee you right now, the culture of prison within Scandinavia is probably vastly different than the culture of prison within the United States. But people might say, well, that's because, Mario, the culture of prison within the United States is just it's hostile. It's toxic. I don't know. Back in the 70s or so in the prison system in Ohio before they instituted the Prison Rape Elimination Act, I mean, I don't know why you'd have to institute an act when you know it's probably not a good idea to rape people in prison. But the fact that new inmates would come in and they would just, you know, pimp them out to other inmates. We didn't know. Yeah, that used to happen within the Ohio system. Within most prison systems, right? Rikers Island, I mean, come on. If you think people care about this, I guarantee you they don't. Because the same folks in your nice little Richie place like Martha's Vineyard who are paying for the immigrants to get bussed out or sent somewhere else or put up in hotels or what have you, not, it's the not in my backyard mentality. N-M-I-B-Y, the not in my backyard. If you want a better example of what not in my backyard refers to, look at the recent situation of DeSantis flying illegals to Martha's Vineyard. Those folks say, no, no, you can't stay here. You got to go somewhere else. That is the epitome of not in my backyard. Who's a hooker? Well, here's the deal, Lavender. As some may say, just matters if she has a good mouth. So, too soon for that. So there's the Marginal Revolution Project. So that's great there. Dateline September 13th, 2022, from our friends over at Dublin News. Is it meth woman? A meth woman was terrified when an ordinary walk in a nearby woods took a chilling turn. She took to Twitter to try to explain her supernatural ordeal after walking through two trees. The woman then became completely lost without being able to find her way back on path. Others quickly said that fairies were at play and explained that Irish folklore may be far more real than many think. Thankfully, the former skeptic remembered an old trick that she had heard in stories. She told Dublin Live that she would be hesitant to return after her experience, especially after hearing a terrifyingly light female voice coming from both sides. She said, I just had to get my steps up for a challenge that we were doing in work. What? I decided to go walk somewhere nice instead of just doing laps of my estate. It was a nice day, so I would go for a walk in the woods. What was the worst that could happen? It was going fine, then the path leads through two identical trees. I stepped through and put my hands on both trees. People are saying now that was a mistake. One was really warm, and the other was really wet and cold. I walked on, and I think I took a left. The main path kind of branched off to the left, and it went somewhere, nowhere, went nowhere, I'm sorry. It went into a really overgrown forest, really high weeds and plants. I knew it wasn't the path. There were lots of people around. It's a really popular spot, so I walked back and thought that this wasn't the main path. I should have taken the other way. So she's moving on with her entire story. When do we get to the clothes coming off? Don't we get to the clothes coming off? Oh, no. Just scary stories here. I have a very professional job. I'm not crazy. I'm quite logical. But then the call came from the other side of me. I knew something wasn't right. Something was just wrong. My first instinct was to run, but I didn't even know where to run. I just remember turning your clothes inside out is supposed to help. So I just tried that. I felt like it was just mental. I just had to do it. I turned my shirt inside out, put it back on. I was hoping nobody was looking at me because it was really a weird thing to do in the middle of the forest. I turned around and walked back and almost immediately came to the two trees again. When I turned around and came back, I came to them quicker than when I had been walking in the opposite direction. When I got back to the car, I looked at my steps. The last time I checked my step counter, I had done 8,000 steps or something like that. I put out an extra 10,000 steps. Oh. So apparently you go in the woods, if you hear voices, you turn your clothes inside out, and that wards off the evil spirits. So that's what's going on. Huh. Apparently in Irish culture they say to turn your clothes inside out because it confuses the fairy folk. Oh. Why does that confuse them? I don't know why it's confusing. Apparently the author W. E. Wentz in the book The Fairy Faith in Celtic Countries documents this popular folklore, and apparently it's fairly popular on Ireland in Cornwall. Apparently, the important thing is to put them back on but reversed. And sometimes just switching your gloves is enough to make your intent known. Now, in paradoxical undressing, people are in the final stages of hypothermia and are madly ripping off their clothes, right? Because your nerve endings feel super hot. So it's not a learned cultural behavior, but a response to freezing to death, which I think is an unpleasant way to go. But apparently if you start hearing voices, you should just, you know, turn your clothes inside out and, you know, the fairies will leave you. I did. Okay. All right. Whatever that is. All right. I don't know anything about that. So, apparently kids, it's coming. The missing 411 UFO connection, the official trailer. I didn't know about this. Not even my double top secret research, but this isn't clickbait. This isn't fake. You can find it on the YouTube channel. Here it is. It's the missing 411, the UFO connection, the official trailer.
This is the location of a missing hunter.
So it looks like people are snatched off the ground, and then some of them are dropped back miles and miles away.
For thousands of years, the human species has looked to the skies in amazement at unidentified objects. We are staring at unconventional possibilities supported by witnesses, video, and most recently, our own government. I have investigated hundreds of cases that push the limits of standard everyday police protocol.
You have investigated hundreds of cases that you've omitted specific details that just simply lead to your narrative that people are being abducted by the mysterious Bigfoot UFO trans-dimensional portal monster. That's what you've been doing, Politus. And here's another thing. He's coming out with this because he's losing subscribers, and he needs to get back on the bandwagon. And the only way he can do that is say, you know what? Maybe it's time. Maybe it's time for me to say that the aliens are coming and abducting these people. What a dick.
The three witnesses saw this object picking up the elk.
There was no cable. Nothing discernible holding the elk to the craft.
Nobody saw a UFO coming and picking up elk. This is the stupidest thing I have ever heard. And why does nobody ever have a video of this? No one ever has a video of this. So I was sitting in my backyard and, well, shit, saw this UFO craft coming and picked up three of my elk. Oh, now I got to file a claim with the insurance company because I got three missing elk. It was a UFO. And what do aliens want with elk? Are they carnivores? I don't get it.
I know what happened to me. It happened in 1974. Next thing I know, I was in this cubicle.
In many stories, children are right there, and then the next second they're gone. After reading thousands of reports, I started to document what is called profile points.
Gosh, this guy is, They are making this appear as if this is the most researched the cream of the cream research. And here's the problem with this dude. He's one guy who has not tested anything. I mean, this is just a shitty trailer. I'm sorry.
The number one profile point is lack of scent trail.
Oh, for crying out loud. We've gone over this. Why dogs lose scent. We've mentioned this numerous times. Do a simple internet search. I guarantee you there is nobody with any credibility in this documentary that is worth his or her salt when it comes to search and rescue. I guarantee you. Guarantee you.
It was unusual that they had that many tracking dogs. I've never found a track.
The more you hear, the stranger the story gets. Why send a SWAT team on a missing person case?
When I saw that, that's when I, you know, went down on my knees.
They are connected to extra-dimensional beings. Those are real.
How do you explain to a grieving family that something paranormal may be tied to the disappearance?
Oh my gosh. This is so bad. This is so bad. This is just horrible. David Politis presents Missing 411, The UFO Connection. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. Well, again, here we go. Here we go, kids. You know, the physical evidence shows people die from environmental exposure, starvation, dehydration, suicide, drug use, I don't know, murder, mental illness, drowning, just plain old accidents, medical conditions. You know, the old people have heart attacks, animal attacks, hypothermia, hyperthermia, foul play, what am I missing? So on and so on. Just getting lost. Now, the people who are found never say, well, I was abducted by an alien. That's amazing. That's simply amazing. They never say, I was abducted by an alien. And also, a hiker having a German last name is not evidence that the person was abducted by a UFO. Right? I mean, just. He's going down Skinwalker Ranch, curse of Oak Island, making vague claims, taking that vain claim route because that's what gets viewership. Right? That's what it is now. Right, he got caught up in too many mistakes and called out too many times for his errors with all of his missing 411 cases. You know, he got annexed from the Bigfoot community. His last documentary, you know, the Coons case, what a complete effing disaster. Now he's going for UFOs. Why? Why? Because he hasn't really mined that community yet, right? I mean, gosh, man alive, this is just sad, sad. I mean, it's a money grab, kids. It's a money grab. But again, you know, what more? And we're not trying to make money off, the work. I mean, it's just crazy. It's just crazy. You know, I mean, I at first it was people missing in national parks and it moved to people missing in the cities. Then he goes on coast to coast AM. And then it was the kids, then hunters, then national parks. Right? Talking about some letter from some national park guy sent him. Who? Right? Then the hysteria of Skinwalker Ranch made him change his mind. Right? His films are not entertaining. They are just dumb. Here's the thing. If you got nothing better to do and you're hanging out at home and you want to watch how not to do a documentary and how to present the... If you're a student who wants a better example of how not to do research... Watch a David Politis Missing 411 video or watch one of his documentaries. There's confirmation bias all over the place. Wow. I mean, just, you know, I don't know what made them change. Don't know what made it change, right? I mean, apparently before pre-COVID days at his conferences, he had people challenge his assertions and conclusions. He always wrote them off and silenced them by refusing to engage in a productive conversation. No one, you know, I've opened up on this show to his ilk, to his villagers. Here's some simple questions. Never. Right? Right? Let him sell the mystery. But again, just stop. Stop, Paulides, misrepresenting, manipulating the missing and the dead. This is just bad. You know, somebody goes missing. You know what? We haven't found your person. I tend to think they may have been abducted by aliens. I just, come on. You know, I mean, just, it's just sad, man. It's just, I don't even know. I just keep saying it's just horrible. Just bad as in bad, bad. Just bad, kids. Just bad. Speaking of missing people. Dateline, the Portsmouth Herald. Missing Sanford family finally located. Here's what they told authorities who found them. I bet you it wasn't a UFO. Sanford, Maine, the local family that has been missing for more than 2 months, has been found, according to authorities. They are safe, unharmed, and want to be left alone. At the involved party's request, no information as to their location or motive for departure, the Springville area, will be disclosed, according to the Sanford Police Department, reported it on its Facebook page Friday morning. Jill Sidebotham, 28, of Springville, her ex-boyfriend Nicholas Hansen, and the 2-year-old daughter Lydia, went missing earlier this summer. Sidebotham's parents, Ron and Cotty, said they last saw their daughter and granddaughter on June 28th. Sidebotham had told her mother that day that she and Lydia were going camping with Hansen and would be back on June 30th at the latest, as she had plans for celebrating the 4th of July locally with her fiancé and her 10-year-old son. But what's up, honey? But Sidebotham and her daughter never returned, touching off a search for them and Hansen that involved efforts by local, state, and federal enforcement agencies. Authority conducted their search digitally, canvassed by both land and air, and sought information on social media. The National Center for Missing and Endangered Children was also involved. The family's whereabouts had not been known since July the 2nd, when they were seen on videotape making purchases at a Walmart in Mexico, Maine. Never knew there was a place. Video footage from June 29th showed Sidebotham, Hansen, and Lydia had indeed gone camping at the Coos Canyon Campground in Byron. On Tuesday, September 6th, however, investigators were able to make contact with each party and communicate with them via phone and video chat, according to the Sanford Police. The Sanford Police Department can report that each party is unharmed and safe, and no evidence of criminal behavior has been observed. Authorities who met with Sidebotham, Hansen, and Liddy also verified that they were safe. At the involved party's request, no information as to their location or motive for departing will be disclosed. No, you can't come up here, meow meow. In early August, Sidebotham's father gave his opinion on his daughter's disappearance and lack of follow-up communication were out of character for her, especially given she has a 10-year-old son back in Sanford Springvale. Ron Sidebotham said his daughter adored her son. It's just not in her heart to do this, Sidebotham said at the time. There are so many factors that shy away from her doing this voluntarily. You know what? My guess is that the ex-boyfriend and the current girlfriend reconnected, as they say. Then they just left. Right? These things happen. These things happen, kids. All right. What else? Oh, Dateline Pocket Worthy. The length of Earth's days has been mysteriously increasing, and scientists don't know why. Oh. Perhaps the rotation of the Earth is slowing down. Atomic clocks combined with precise astronomical measurements have revealed the length of a day is suddenly getting longer, and scientists do not know why. This has critical impacts not just on our timekeeping, but also things like GPS and other technologies that govern our modern life. Over the past few decades, Earth rotation around its axis, which determined how long a day is, has been speeding up. This trend has been making our days shorter. In fact, in June 2022, we set a record for the shortest day over the past half of a century. Wait. But despite this record since 2020, this steady speed up has curiously switched to a slowdown, right? We're pumping the brakes, kids. We're pumping the brakes. Days are getting longer again. And the reason, so far, is a mystery. While the clock and our phone indicate there are exactly 24 hours in a day, the actual time it takes the Earth to complete a single rotation varies ever so slightly. These changes occur over periods of millions of years and almost instantly. Even earthquakes and storms events can play a role. It turns out a day is very rarely exactly the magic number of 86,400 seconds over millions of years. Earth's rotation has been slowing down due to friction effects associated with tides driven by the moon. That process adds about 2.3 milliseconds to the length of each day every century. A few billion years ago, the Earth day was about 19 hours. For the past 20,000 years, another process has been working in the opposite direction, speeding up Earth's rotation. When the last ice age ended, melting polar ice sheets reduced surface pressure, and Earth's mantle started steadily moving toward the poles. Just as a ballet dancer spins faster as they bring their arms toward their body, the axis which they spin, so our planet's spin rate increases when the massive mantle moves closer to Earth's axis. And this process shortens each day by about 0.6 milliseconds each century. So here's my question. This means what? I don't know. Earth is slowing down, speeding up. It is what it is. But still, let's call it 24 hours in a day. You still work 8 hours a day. You still got 16 hours of your own free time, of which probably eating, sleeping, friends, family accumulates about 10 hours. Therefore, you only have about 6 hours of sleep every night. I don't know what Pat is putting in the chat here, but it looks like somebody's crying about who knows what. I don't know. They're crying for some reason. Sorry, I'm just, just chilling like a villain from Compton U, kids. That's all I'm doing. Chilling like a villain from Compton U. I got nothing. All right, folks, let's go down the path of comedy and listen to a classic from the disgraced but free William H. Cosby.
Never forget the time I had a sore throat, bad sore throat. And I said,
I have a sore throat.
And my mother said, let me feel your forehead. Mothers are always feeling things, you know. Let me feel your head. Let me feel your arm. Doctors do that too. A lot of doctors do that. They're wonderful people. No, I love doctors, but there's only two things I've found fault with. I can find fault with the doctors. One, you could have a busted leg. Your leg could be hanging out, and the guy will still want to feel it. You know, let me feel it. Does that hurt? Hey! Yeah, does that hurt? And they always keep the stethoscope in the freezer. I warm that thing up with my hands. Whenever I go to see my doctor, I grab a stethoscope. I pull it right out of the refrigerator, and I start warming it up with my hands. And they put that cold thing on you, and they say, take a deep breath. Oh! You can't help but take a deep breath. The problem is trying to breathe out now. So I'm sitting on the emergency ward with my sore throat, and the doctor comes out. He says, what's the matter? He says, son, my son has a sore throat. I said, okay, take a look at it. Ah. Say ah. Oh. So, oh, well, this is it. I said, he's really got tonsillitis, Mrs. Cosby. Oh, all right, well, what do you want to do? Well, We usually do a tonsillectomy on Wednesday, which is the day after tomorrow. You can leave him here tonight. Are you guys gonna leave him? You're not leaving me nowhere. Can't my mother sleep with me? No, your mother's not gonna sleep with me. Well, somebody's gotta sleep with me. I'm not sleeping nowhere by myself. Well, you're just gonna, we're gonna operate on you. Operate who? Now, don't let them operate on me. Please, don't let them do nothing bad. What are they gonna cut? Well, don't worry about it. It's just gonna cut two things in your throat. Two things in my throat! And then I won't be able to talk or what? Yes, you'll be able to talk. Listen, son, let me explain it to you. Your tonsils, which we're gonna have to take out, guard your throat, you see. They stand there, they're two guards, they have hand grenades, bazookas, and everything. And anything bad that comes into your mouth, they fight it off. See, well, in your case, your tonsils have lost the war. As a matter of fact, your tonsils have gone as far as to join the other side, you see. And they're going to kill you if we don't cut them out. Well, they're going to hurt and everything. No, we're not going to hurt you. Now, listen, as a matter of fact, listen to me now. When they cut your tonsils out, don't you know, are you ready for the lie? They'll give you all the ice cream in the world you can eat. Is that right? I can have all ice cream in the world I can eat? Yes, I'm not kidding. You don't tell me no fibs now, Mom. No, I'm not kidding. You all the ice cream, say honest to God. Honest to God. Boy, you guys are in trouble. Because I can eat a mess of ice cream, I'm telling you now. One time I ate a whole elephant full of chocolate. Hey, can I have chocolate? You can have chocolate. Oh, boy. Take me wherever I'm supposed to go now. You can cut off my whole neck for some chocolate ice cream, man. So they marched me in, and I turned in my civvies, and they gave me that... They gave me that hospital thing that you put on where the back is open. And you're afraid to, you know, your back away from people. And you bump into the walls in there, you know, marble wall, ice cold. And the iron cribs are ice cold. It's so cold, you stick to the cribs, you know. And, gee whiz, man. So I marched on a ward, and they introduced me to my two buddies. This is Johnson.
Hey, Johnson, how you doing? You gonna get some ice cream, too?
Yes, they told me I'd get some ice cream. Yeah, well, listen, man, when the nurse leaves, I'll talk to you about that ice cream later, because we're going to eat a mess of ice cream. And this is Rudolph. How you doing, Rudy? You gonna get some ice
cream? Yeah, I've got ice cream. Yeah, boy, eat it up.
Okay, poor boy. All right, nurse, you may leave now. We're all right. So we sat down. We looked at each other. And we said, ice cream.
Ice cream? We're going to eat ice cream. And we will eat it every day in the middle of the night, man. We're singing, ice cream. It'll eat that ice cream. And the nurses are padding the doors, locking them up. And we're going to eat ice cream. Listen, you know what I'm going to do. When I get my first bowl of ice cream, I'm not even going to touch it. I eat it or nothing. I'm gonna smear it all over my body, man. Just smear it all over my face and eyes and hair and everywhere. And then I'm gonna put a green cherry in my navel. And I'm gonna be the most beautiful chocolate sundae you've ever seen in your life. Ice cream. I'm going to eat ice cream. I'm telling you now, ice cream. Sing along with me now. And the whole day passed, man. Every time the orderly brought by the breakfast cart, man. All right, let's have a breakfast. And we'd eat it up, man. Our stomachs would swell up. We ate so much. You got to keep eating a lot so your stomach will stretch, man. Lunchtime, bring it in. Ah, eating everything. Make it stretch out. Make it stretch out. Bring in the dinner. Ah, and the supper. Ah, we ate everything, man. Preparing for the ice cream. Okay, and we didn't even sleep the night of surgery. Hey, man, yeah, we're going to get some ice cream and everything. Ice cream. Ice cream! We're going to get ice cream. And that morning, the orderly went by with the breakfast cart. Hey! You, almost a doctor! sleep this morning.
You're not getting nothing to eat.
How come?
Because you're getting your tonsils out.
Well, what's that got to do with it?
When you get your tonsils out, you can't have any food in your stomach because you throw up.
Are you kidding? One time I ate a dead frog. I didn't throw up or nothing, man. Bring that breakfast cart back here.
And he went away. In came the nurse with the gurney. You know, the gurney's the thing that they put you on to take you down in a surgery. And the wheels on the gurneys are always the same. They always have that wobble like there's a windstorm going on about 6 inches above the ground. That's why a lot of women never make it to the delivery room. Baby's out, take her back. Save money, time and space, you know. So she wheeled it in. We all stood up. Ice cream! We're gonna eat ice cream! All right, now it's time to go to surgery. Who's going first? Take me! No, take me! I wanna go. Dude, you gotta get. Listen, CB4, V, and S. You guys hit strawberry for now, and I'm C as alphabetically. I go first, you know. No, we're gonna take Johnson, because he was here first. Oh, sure.
Okay, Johnson, go ahead, man. Get that ice cream. Cut it up, man. All right, go ahead, Johnson.
Johnson stepped on a gurney. Well, suckers, I guess you know what this means. If they run out of strawberry, vanilla and chocolate are definitely in jeopardy.
Okay, Johnson, don't eat it up from us, though. Hey, Johnson, go ahead, babe.
And we sat down, man. We looked at each other.
Ice cream! We're going to eat ice cream. And boom, Johnson's back! Okay, are you ready? Yeah, me too. Go ahead, Jess. Hey, Jess, wake up. Hey, Jess, how come your eyeballs just keep waving around in the air? Nice, ain't it? That's ketchup, right? That's ketchup on his mouth, coming around from his mouth. Ain't it ketchup? Please, that's ketchup, because we ain't the thing that you killed, Johnson. They killed Johnson. They picked him up. Johnson was like a wet rag. Oh, man. I picked the bottle up and broke it. All right, who's next? Get away from me. Okay, fight him off, Rudy. I'll hit him off here. They ain't touching neither one of us. Rudy started crying. Oh, no, no. Rudy had the funniest cry you ever wanted to see. He would run whenever he cried. Oh, no. And they picked him up and they strapped him down on the gurney, man, and they took him away. Rudy, keep fighting, babe. Keep fighting. Just remember one thing. Keep your mouth closed. Johnson, wake up, babe. Ice cream. You gotta sing with me. Ice cream. Oh, he's dancing. Boom. All right, Rudy, did you keep it? No, he didn't keep it. They got it.
Okay, William, you're next. Well, wait. Before you touch me, I have a confession to make. Does it mean anything to you if I say that I just had breakfast? Okay, I'll go peacefully. And they put me on a gurney. And they covered me up with a sheet up to my neck. They put me on the elevator. And I knew I was going to die. And I hadn't really prepared myself for it. And it was pitiful. You know, when you're only 5 years old and your life passes before you, it's pitiful, man. You really don't have that much of a life to pass before you. It was just a little, and then it was gone. I had to call for a rerun. And he brought me into surgery. Doctors and nurses all got their masks on so you can't tell who they are. And they put a needle in my arm and let the thing go.
And the doctor said, count backwards from 100. 100, 9. I didn't even make it to the second 9. I was so pitiful. Of course, now, I understand that if you're an alcoholic, you can last longer. Now, if they ever get my old man on an offer, they're really in trouble, man. I know Dad will give him trouble. 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Now, what else do you want me to do? I think you better get another bottle. Yeah, that's what I need, a bottle. You better give me a bottle. Not for the arm, for the mouth. Anything press me through the table. And I remember I wanted to wake up. Wake up, wake up, wake up. Yep, and it's time to wake up. Okay. Well, why don't you open your eyes? Nope, don't want to. How come? Well, because every time I open my eyes, the room starts to act silly. Going around in circles and I'm jumping up and down. I don't wanna wake up. I just stay like this, half awake, half asleep, and just hum a little bit. How's your mouth feel? Oh, it's dry. Very dry. And your tongue? Oh, it's dry too, yeah. And the lips are dry, and the tongue is dry, and the mouth is dry, and the throat is dry, and everything is dry, 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 dry. What, do you want to swallow? Yep. Well, why don't you? Nobody asked me. All right, try and give it a little swallow. Okay.
Hello, brain? Yes, this is throat. Yeah, you better get some work done down here. Somebody killed the kid or something.
Hello? Hello, kid?
Mm-hmm.
You want to try and swallow?
Mm-mm.
Try and swallow again. We want to check out the trouble.
No.
Try it. Come on. Do this over.
A classic from the free, but I believe still disgraced, Bill Cosby. I almost literally forgot am I having an aneurysm? Who I was talking about? That was that. By 1927, Buster Keaton was one of Hollywood's brightest and wealthiest stars, with a lavish Italian-style villa to go with it. But the marriage of Buster and Natalie Keaton was already a failure. 6 years after their wedding, the Keatons were at last installed with two small sons and an impossibly lavish grounds of an Italian villa. They had achieved the picture postcard version of heterosexual Hollywood bliss. In fact, tinted photographs of their house appeared on real picture postcards for the tourist trade. Yet, they were by all accounts sexually and emotionally estranged. The separate bedroom Buster had been exiled to in 1924 had become a whole separate wing. For her part, Natalie, perhaps tired of being known as the mousy younger sister of the glamorous Talmadge's was gaining a reputation as one of the movie colony's most extravagant shoppers. According to rumor, she spent something like $900 a week, more than $14,000 in today's dollars, on clothes. Who was the best dresser in Hollywood went the joke Buster Keaton because he dresses Natalie. Their sons later remembered an early childhood day-to-day affection came mainly from nurses, governesses, and two doting child movie star aunts. The Keatons' vision of marriage as the first stop on a sped-up train ride to the grave is a prime example, if not a grimmer register, that the comedian's usual of the stoic philosophy that Robert Sherwood saw in all of his work, the vitally important fact that life, after all, is a foolishly inconsequential affair. From Dana Stevens, cameraman, from Atria Books, 2022, pages 208 to 213, a copyright. That ends the first hour. Next hour, we'll head over to Bedtime Stories. Until then, get up, stretch your legs, have some food. Perhaps Jer Bear will visit us this evening. If not, that's okay. Talk with you shortly.
You. If you're not in control, then someone else is. Join me, Ivy West, for Voices on the Wind, Saturday. I discuss government, health, metaphysics, suppressed science, universal mysteries, little-known incredible facts, alternative energies, and even more than you can imagine. Won't you join us on Revolution Radio Saturdays? For Voices on the Wind, with me, Ivy West.
There are lives in the balance, people under fire, children at the cannons. There are...
Because if your head's in the sand, your tail is a target.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the Internet. Please help support this station so this battle can continue forward. Revolution Radio!
Join me on the Brian Ruse Show on Revolution Radio, Eastern Standard Time, every Tuesday night from 6 to 8. We talk about the four most vital things, in my view, affecting all of humanity. Number one is UFOs and aliens and their agenda for the advancement of humanity. Number two is the Jewish establishment's control over all aspects of human civilization. Number three, the truth about Adolf Hitler, how he was the opposite of what we've been told. Number four is Advanced Ancient Global Civilizations. Join me on The Brian Ruse Show, Tuesday nights from 6 to 8 on Studio B on Revolution Radio.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of this program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
I don't like circuses. I think they abuse animals, just so you know. Nothing is sadder to me. Well, there are some things that are sadder, but it is very sad for me to go to a zoo and see animals just caged up. It's like when, it's no different than when I walk down, drive or walk through a city and I see folks walking their dogs on the sidewalk as they just left a high-rise apartment. I don't care if you have a big dog, little ankle biter, or a mid-sized dog. Dogs just want to run, chase squirrels, play with other dogs, poop, pee, play fetch. Cats, I get it. Cats can just, you know, hang out wherever. They sit in the window and watch the animals outside, but I think it's quite, zoos are sad and so are people that own dogs, regardless of the size, in big cities. Yeah, I know, there's a dog park, but your dog wants to go and sit in a yard and just watch birds all day, right? Wander around. Just want to be stuck in some, you know, 600-square-foot apartment. I think they should outlaw dogs inside the city. Just my opinion. All right, folks. Sit back, relax. Let us join our friends over at Bedtime Stories. Enjoy.
For over half a century, there have been rumors of secretive facilities and bases hidden deep below the surface of the sprawling North American landscape. This week, we examine the most infamous of these alleged sites, an underground base believed to be situated near the town of Dulce in New Mexico, a modern-day mystery which lies deep beneath the mesa. Bringing his patrol car to a halt, Gabriel Valdez stared out through the driver's side window at the dark mass lying not far from the side of the road, and then cursed under his breath. For the briefest of moments, he tried to convince himself that the most sensible course of action would be to simply drive on, away from this place, and to ignore what he had seen. And yet his curiosity urged him to exit the vehicle, to conduct a closer inspection, and confirm what his instincts and fears were telling him. With a heavy sigh, the patrolman used his radio to inform the dispatcher of his location, before opening the driver's side door and making his way across the scrub. Deep down, he had known what he would find before he even reached the carcass. A cursory inspection confirmed that this cadaver had been left just like the others he had attended upon. A series of diamond-shaped indentations had been carved into various points of the hide, with several layers of skin having apparently been removed in an expert fashion. The creature's eyes, nose, and tongue were all missing, despite there being no sign of any wider animal predation having taken place. It was almost certain that the reproductive glands would be absent, as well as a number of other key internal organs, all removed in what presented as a clean and sterile manner. As he stood regarding the lack of any tracks or disturbed foliage on the ground surrounding the animal's corpse, Valdez now became aware of the low rumble of an approaching vehicle. Looking up from the grisly scene, he caught sight of a 5-ton truck painted in army camouflage, heading along the highway towards him. The transport began to slow as it approached the point where he'd left his patrol car, its occupants returning the questioning gaze he had offered as they passed, before it pulled away at greater speed. As he watched the dust cloud thrown up by its passing dissipate, Valdez found himself experiencing a whole host of emotions. Confusion, a small degree of fear, but most of all, he felt anger, directed towards those he blamed for the death of this creature, for the deaths of all the slain animals he had found in recent months, and the wider falsehood that their slaughter had been used to perpetuate. A lie fabricated for one purpose, and one purpose only. To keep local residents away from the neighboring mesa, for fear that something resided there, which neither he, nor any other earthly power, could hope to protect them from. The town of Dulce in New Mexico would not come into existence until the end of the 19th century, when U.S. authorities ordered the local Apache tribe to settle itself permanently in one place. The area's Native American population duly complied with this instruction, forming the Jicarilla Apache Reservation, around which the town would eventually be established. For the next century and a half, the inhabitants of this small backwater community would live their lives in relative peace, a short distance from the slopes of the adjoining Archuleta Mesa. There had always been tales of high strangeness associated with the region, from weird light anomalies witnessed in the night sky to Bigfoot-like creatures seen wandering the scrub. But by the late 1970s, the looming shadow cast by this towering mountain peak would begin to take on a sinister connotation, with the discovery of a series of bizarre cattle mutilations. Following several complaints by ranchers and farmers to the local police department, insisting that someone or something was slaughtering their livestock, an officer by the name of Gabriel Valdez was ordered to investigate the matter. But after visiting the affected properties, the investigator often returned to his superiors with far more questions than answers. Usually, only one animal in the herds which were targeted had been affected, and it had been dispatched in a manner which seemed to discount the involvement of any natural predator. Although key sensory and internal organs had been removed from the carcasses, there were never any indications that the flesh had been consumed by a potential attacker. In fact, these bodies would remain untouched by scavengers for weeks after the event, a phenomenon previously unheard of within this harsh and unrelenting environment. The report submitted by Officer Valdez also highlighted the lack of disturbance in the soft and sandy ground surrounding the remains, offering no hint as to who or what was responsible. Due to the discovery of shattered bones in some cases, his suggestion that the bodies had been dropped from a great height was something he would go on to be questioned over at some length. It soon became apparent to his superiors that Officer Valdez had no fixed agenda, and was not promoting any theory in particular regarding the deaths of these animals. Instead, his report simply documented everything he had encountered during his investigation, and demonstrated that he had discounted all of the most obvious explanations for the deaths. But situations would soon unfold, setting in motion a chain of events, which would quash any hopes the investigator might have had in maintaining a calm and rational assessment of the incidents plaguing his community. During the summer of 1986, a resident named Jerry Julian approached the local police department to report that someone had attempted to abduct her from her home while she was sleeping. Julian explained to the attending officers that the evening prior, she and her husband had driven out in their flatbed truck to the slopes of the Archuleta Mesa to do a bit of stargazing. After a short time, Julian's attention had been drawn to one star in particular, which seemed to be moving through the night sky. As she and her husband looked on in wonder, the celestial body in question suddenly began to descend from the heavens, landing on the ground a short distance away. Gradually, the bright light before them began to diminish, revealing a metallic structure from which a small set of steps descended. Two small figures then slowly made their way down the metallic walkway, before they set off on foot in the direction of the married couple. With a frightened cry, Julian's husband had grabbed her by the shoulders, bundled her into his pickup, and frantically attempted to start the engine. She continued to stare back in terror at the two squat figures slowly advancing upon the vehicle as the engine repeatedly failed to turn over. It was only when the strangers were mere meters away from the rear of the truck, reaching out as if to take hold of it, that the motor suddenly fired into life and allowed the couple to escape. Later that night, having decided not to report the matter, the couple had gone to bed, only for Julian to awaken in the early hours of the morning due to a strange tugging sensation. Looking down towards the bottom of her bed, she could see two shadowy figures, identical to those she had witnessed emerging from the strange craft earlier that night. Suddenly realizing she could feel her sheets being pulled off the bed to expose her lower body, Julian attempted to scream, but nothing more than a hoarse and raspy sound had emerged from her mouth. This quiet whimper, however, had been sufficient to awaken her sleeping husband, at which point the two figures had immediately vanished. When questioned further by federal agents who had been tasked with attending the incident, Julian claimed the existence of these entities was common knowledge amongst the native community. She even went as far to describe a large hole bored deep into the mountain face, hidden away much further up the slopes of the mesa, which she claimed the creatures used to access the surface. Around the same time that the investigators were taking Jerry Julian's statement, separate claims of a possible alien base concealed beneath the Archuleta Mesa were being directed towards the local authorities. Security staff at the Kirtland Air Force Base began to receive a string of detailed allegations from a local businessman, stating that he had documented mysterious activity both above and below the mountain chain. Paul Benowitz was already well known to the senior officers at the base, following reports he'd submitted to them of strange lights in the sky above his home in the Four Valleys district of Albuquerque. He now claimed that in addition to the lights he had filmed, he had intercepted mysterious energy emissions and radio transmissions, and that these were emanating from beneath the mesa. The businessman had also taken to conducting regular flights across the mountains in his private aircraft, photographing anything he deemed out of the ordinary. Invited onto the base to speak in person, he showed them photos of what he believed to be paths and doorways cut into the rock, miles away from any existing road or highway. He drew maps of alleged air vents and access points, and cited interviews he had conducted with the owners of mutilated cattle and locals who claimed to have been abducted in the vicinity of the mesa. But the more detail that the impassioned Benowitz chose to add to this ad hoc briefing, the less credibility he was extended by his audience. He began to panic, citing discussions with shadowy government agents, claiming that the extraterrestrials living below the mountain were one of three separate species to have visited Earth. But it was the assertion that a whole floor of the alleged alien base contained vats filled with human organs and body parts harvested by the alien visitors, which saw him ridiculed and finally escorted off the base. Shortly after this, as the businessman's mental health and coherence continued to deteriorate, he suffered a nervous breakdown. On the advice of doctors, his family applied to have him committed to a psychiatric facility in 1988, seemingly removing any shred of credibility his initial reports to the military may have contained. But perhaps the most amazing aspect of the stories told by Paul Benowitz is that they are by no means the only such detailed allegations of a secret base concealed beneath the town of Dulce. During the mid-1990s, a former Air Force technician by the name of Thomas Castello went public, confirming that there was indeed a hidden facility underneath the Archuleta Mesa. More incredible still was that Castello claimed that this was not an extraterrestrial base, but one constructed by the United States government, where aliens and human scientists worked together on genetic experiments. Castello related how he had been a US Air Force photographer based at Nellis in Las Vegas, but in the early 1970s had been transferred to the secret Dulce base in New Mexico. Whilst there, he was responsible for maintaining the facility's extensive surveillance network and for documenting some of the work being conducted in the laboratories. Castello even went as far as to offer photographic evidence with his testimony of what he purported to be some form of alien hybrid suspended in a vat of fluid in one of the labs. But barely had journalists time to digest his claims that the Dulce base was just one of many such facilities linked by a vast underground railroad network before he disappeared from public view altogether. However, his claims would later resurface when a further whistleblower came forward, this time from within the ranks of the Dulce Police Department itself. A former reservation police detective named Avery Tafoya, who had been researching the testimony of Jerry Julian, related how he had stumbled across the report written by federal investigators assigned to the case. To his amazement, in addition to the events described by the victim, they had included detailed drawings of a sprawling military facility, exactly where Julian claimed the hidden opening in the mountain was situated. The drawings depicted that the base had seven different levels, including accommodation blocks, storage facilities and laboratories. It was also serviced by an underground train network similar to that alleged by Thomas Castello. Armed with this information, Tafoya stated that he had made a number of attempts to climb the mountain and see the facility for himself, only to be defeated by adverse weather conditions on each and every occasion. Not to be deterred, he had then used a thermal camera to document strange apertures and vents built into the rock of the mountain, and recorded what sounded like large machines being operated beneath the slopes. Over the years, the United States military has gone to great lengths in denying that Dulce Base exists, or that it's part of a network of hidden underground facilities. And it would seem that part of their strategy to do so has involved a concerted effort to undermine the credibility of those making the claims. The background of Thomas Castello remains shrouded in uncertainty, with attempts to locate and review his military service records seeming to suggest he never existed. Photographs associated with his testimony have proven to be forgeries, and no formal interview with him has ever been unearthed. Members of the intelligence community have also come forward and admitted to deliberately feeding false information to Paul Benowitz. It is alleged that having become uncomfortable with his obsession and surveillance of the secure Manzano weapons storage complex, the Air Force invented the fictional Dulce base in order to distract the businessman. They even claim to have placed machinery and fake air vents on the Archuleta Mesa for him to photograph, in order to convince him that a base existed there and draw him away from genuine military facilities. Gabriel Valdez himself has always refused to believe stories of a base at the Mesa, extraterrestrial or otherwise. Prior to his death in 2011, the former police officer told his son that he believed it was humans who had mutilated the cattle near the town, and not aliens. He cited secretive nuclear testing in and around New Mexico during the 1960s, claiming samples had secretly been removed from local cattle to test for radiation poisoning. There are equally detailed cases both for and against the existence of a base beneath the Archuleta Mesa, and the secretive work which is allegedly being conducted there. With so many stories, it is difficult to know which sources to trust. It is not beyond all possibility that the US government is in possession of secret underground military bases, constructed well away from prying eyes. But at the same time, some of the claims attached to them seem so outlandish that they push any notion of their existence towards ridicule. However, throughout this episode, we have deliberately avoided the most detailed and impassioned evidence for such an underground structure at Dulce. That of a man who claimed he was a former worker at the secretive site and had survived a horrifying battle unfolding between human and extraterrestrial forces during the excavation of what would become the eventual facility there. In our previous episode, we examined reports from various individuals who stated that there is a secret facility buried deep beneath the New Mexico town of Dulce, but we deliberately avoided the testimony of one man, who is arguably the most controversial figure in the allegations surrounding the possible existence of Dulce Base. A man who claimed he was the survivor of a war beneath the Mesa. Having sought shelter behind an equipment crate of sufficient size, the lieutenant now tried to take stock of the situation. At least three members of his platoon were gone, their bodies charred beyond all recognition following exposure to the horrific weaponry employed by their opponents. Despite this, they had managed to push the enemy force deeper into the facility, as they had been ordered to do so, and if they could just secure the stairwell in front of them, the mission would be a success. Waving across the corridor, where two more of his team members were sheltering behind another crate, he began to issue a series of orders using hand signals. Moments later, the pair were up on their feet and heading towards the looming metal door, each tightly clutching a satchel charge. Their intention was clear. But before they could reach their objective, the door suddenly sprung wide open. A skeletal figure materialized from the darkness within, followed by a terrifying bright blue energy discharge from its weapon. The two soldiers did not even have time to cry out, as their bodies were engulfed in a ball of brilliant blue flame. Almost immediately, an infantryman further down the corridor, operating the platoon's M60 heavy machine gun, opened fire, shredding the attacker with a steady hail of gunfire. More soldiers then ran forwards, snatching up the discarded satchel charges and priming them, before hurling them in through the open doorway. There was an enormous explosion, immediately followed by a shower of dust and debris as the stairwell caved in, preventing their enemy from accessing this floor or any others which lay above them. Leaving two of his men to cover the collapsed structure, the lieutenant and the remainder of his platoon made their way back up through the facility towards the main loading area. But upon his arrival, he was shocked to see that two further army trucks had arrived, discharging several more squads of soldiers wearing black uniforms, who hurried towards the corridors from which he and his men had just emerged. Turning to his commanding officer, he abruptly inquired as to what was taking place, who this unit were, and why they were now heading underground towards the lower levels. Curtly dismissed, he and his fellow Navy SEALs could only watch on as the mysterious soldiers continued to head deeper into the base, where so many US soldiers had already lost their lives in an effort to contain the marauding extraterrestrial threat. During the summer of 1995, Phil Schneider gave a series of lectures across the United States, in which he went to great pains to highlight to his audience the dangers of what he was doing. He spoke of the murder of his close friend, which he alleged had been made to look like a suicide. Then he related various attempts on his own life, and threats to harm his family in an effort to stop him from sharing confidential military secrets with the public. But Schneider explained that his love for his country superseded any thoughts for his personal safety, that the American people had a right to know the potential dangers which their government was hiding from them. He would open his talks by explaining how he came from a family of public servants, how his father had been a military officer who worked on the Manhattan Project. Then he would reveal to those present the fingers missing from his left hand, relating how he had lost them whilst fighting to regain control of a secret military installation from extraterrestrial attackers. Schneider would hold up bizarre-looking metals and minerals, claiming that they were products of experiments which had been kept hidden from the American people. He would then explain in great detail how there was a vast network of underground military bases beneath the surface of North America, linked together by miles and miles of magnetic train tracks. Finally, he would close his lectures by saying that when his time came, just like his friend, his murder would be made to look like a suicide, reiterating that he had no wish to end his own life. Less than a year later, the impassioned public speaker would indeed be found dead in his apartment. His death, perhaps unsurprisingly to anybody who had ever heard him speak, ultimately being ruled a suicide. Much as the former Air Force Sergeant Thomas Costello had done before him, Phil Schneider told anyone who would give him the time that there was a military base hidden deep beneath the Archuleta Mesa. But unlike the enigmatic Costello, Schneider chose to deliver his evidence in a far more public manner, speaking openly to roomfuls of interested people and fielding any questions they might have concerning his account. He described how, since the end of the Second World War, the United States government had been building a vast network of underground bases around the country. Schneider explained that to his knowledge, there were 129 deep underground military bases, or DUMs, hidden beneath the plains, mesas, and mountain ranges of North America. 9 of these were clustered in close proximity to one another, located in and around Groom Lake, near the infamous Area 51 testing facility in Nevada. All of these bases were linked by a seemingly endless series of tunnels, which housed a maglev train line, allowing workers to travel between the locations at speeds of up to Mach 2. As he stood and summarized how these tunnels had been created and how each of the secret bases had been constructed, audiences found themselves visibly impressed by the level of technical detail Schneider used. Having listed his credentials as a geologist and structural engineer, he related how he had been brought onto the project to assist with the complicated and advanced construction methods being used. The maglev tunnels had not been drilled or blasted through the ground, but had instead been created using laser technology that vitrified and melted its way through the previously impenetrable rock. In order to create each base, four gaping holes were bored deep into the earth. Each separate floor was then blasted out of the rock before being linked up to these four gigantic corner shafts. And it was amidst the construction of one facility in New Mexico during the late 1970s that Phil Schneider became an unwitting participant in what would become known as the Dulce War. Schneider maintained that in August of 1979, construction on the Dulce base had begun to fall behind schedule due to issues relating to the drilling of one of the corner columns. The facility was being tunneled out beneath the southwest corner of the Archuleta Mesa, but every time the drilling team had attempted to pass a certain depth, they found that their machinery was mysteriously failing. In an effort to discover what was frustrating the drilling operation, Schneider and a Green Beret bodyguard had been lowered into the incomplete shaft via a crane. But as soon as he stepped out of the crane basket into what appeared to be a pre-existing cave network, he had instantly realized that something was very wrong. There was a bitter and unnatural stench in the air, as the drilling operation had now allowed ancient gases to escape from the void beneath, along with a mysterious and sooty residue on the unusually smooth walls of the caves. It was at this point that a tall and slender grey figure had suddenly stepped out of the shadows in front of him, carrying what appeared to be a weapon of some description. Utterly terrified by this creature's unearthly and intimidating appearance, Schneider had used his sidearm to kill it, only for two more to then emerge out of the darkness behind. Backing towards the crane basket and firing wildly, the engineer had managed to fell one of the pair, only for the other to then use its own weapon upon him in retaliation. Schneider was instantly consumed by an eerie blue light and felt a huge jolt of electricity burst through his body, which had sent him crashing to the cave floor. When he came to, he found himself being bundled into the crane basket by the Green Beret, who then turned and engaged more of the creatures as the basket began to ascend without him. Upon his return to the surface, the doctors who treated Schneider found severe damage to both his left hand and foot, with several fingers and toes missing. After he had explained to his superiors what had taken place, he was removed from the project, but later discovered that construction had continued despite his encounter. For the next year, it was alleged that further battles beneath the mesa ensued as US Special Forces clashed with alien interlopers, who appeared intent on frustrating the construction of the base. Schneider claims that in total, 66 soldiers and countless extraterrestrials lost their lives before an uneasy peace was finally formed between the two opposing sides. He went on to allege that the aliens who had been residing beneath the mesa had worked with humans ever since, creating numerous scientific breakthroughs which had gone on to assist mankind. Throughout 1995, Schneider continued to tour the United States, giving talks in which he listed numerous other alleged conspiracies alongside the revelations of deep underground military bases. Over the course of these lectures, however, it soon became apparent that the former engineer was beginning to struggle with what he had started. He described how he had been involved in a shootout with federal agents, killing one in self-defense, and how an attempt had been made to kidnap his daughter in a bid to force him to stop delivering his lectures. Then, in January of 1996, 2 months after his final speech in Denver, federal agents arrived at the home of Schneider's ex-wife, Cynthia. They explained how Phil had been found dead in his apartment in Wilsonville, having apparently decided to take his own life. The agents went on to conduct a search of Cynthia's house, removing any notes or materials relating to Phil and his lectures, before then leaving. The circumstances surrounding Schneider's death have always raised questions about the speed with which the authorities moved to attribute it to suicide. Phil's body had been found slumped between his bed and wheelchair, with a rubber catheter hose having been wrapped around his neck 3 times and tied off with a knot. Both his feet were wedged hard underneath the bed, with his head resting in the seat of the wheelchair at an angle that would not appear to have been easy or natural for him to achieve. There were traces of blood on the floor nearby, but no injuries or wounds were found on the body itself to suggest where this may have come from. When the family later asked if a suicide note had been discovered, they were told that all the papers seized from the address had now inexplicably gone missing from a police storage facility. Subsequent requests for additional toxicology testing on Schneider's remains were refused on the grounds of adverse cost, considering the cause of death had already been determined. Further and more adamant demands for these tests would also be refused, because the samples had apparently been destroyed by the laboratory which had been storing them. One detective, who later spoke privately with the family, stated that with the missing fingers on Schneider's left hand, it would have been almost impossible for him to have tied off the catheter himself. When the officer in question had shared these concerns with his superiors, he had been ordered to keep his observations to himself, before then being reassigned to a different case. It appeared that even in death, Phil Schneider was continuing to raise awkward and uneasy questions for those in positions of authority. When taken in context of the many accounts which already exist regarding a possible underground base at Dulce, the testimony of Phil Schneider appears to be compelling. Many of the experimental compounds and construction techniques he listed during the course of his lectures were mere concepts during the late 20th century, but have gone on to become commonplace in modern building work. His descriptions of the base layout and the functions of each of the 7 levels were also eerily similar to those offered by other witnesses, people whom he'd never met or associated with. And yet, even the lightest touch of scrutiny has shown his accounts to be marred by falsehoods and inaccuracies, which make it difficult to take some of his claims seriously. He made repeated assertions that his father, Otto Oscar Schneider, was a German U-boat captain who had been captured by the US Navy and then turned against the Nazi regime. Yet a cursory search of both German and American wartime records shows this to be an apparent fabrication, with Otto having been born in San Francisco in January of 1906. Similarly, his claims that the original attack on the World Trade Center involved the use of a tactical nuclear weapon, and that the occupants of Waco Ranch had been murdered using chemical weapons, have apparently been debunked. These revelations would appear to suggest that Phil Schneider was an individual prone to exaggeration, sometimes verging on the edge of delusion. But if this was the case, then where did he sustain his life-changing injuries? And what happened to the missing samples and notes he had brought with him to his lectures? Why is there so much evidence that he was silenced by unknown persons, and efforts made to present his murder as a suicide? Schneider's detractors argue that he was not a well man, and merely seized upon the alleged testimony of Thomas Costello, using it to conjure up a fantastical backstory of his own. But to his supporters, the inconsistencies in his account are explained away as the US government rewriting his family history, designed specifically to undermine Schneider's credibility and keep prying eyes away from the Dulce base. They point to the same methods used against Bob Lazar and his removal from college and employment records as an example of the lengths the US government will go to cover up such revelations. With the advent of the internet, Each passing year sees more information on classified military projects slowly creeping into the public domain. It is therefore entirely possible that at some future point, evidence proving the existence of deep underground military bases will finally materialize. Or it may be that advances in technology enable investigators to finally disprove the existence of such facilities once and for all. For now at least, it seems there is a lot more digging to be done.
All right, welcome back. Thanks to our friends with our bedtime stories. You know, I get a little tired of listening to the Bob Lazar, and Bob Lazar acting as if he's, you know, people who claim that Bob Lazar is the grandfather and the accurate person, and, you know, because Stan Friedman supported him, all this BS and BS as an S. So as some of you are aware, on November 11th and 13th of 1989, viewers of KLAS-TV in Las Vegas, Nevada, home of Jer Bear, well, they were witnesses, audio witnesses, to the incredible story from news reporter George Knapp. Yes, the George Knapp. A scientist had come forth to reveal that the U.S. government possesses the remains of extraterrestrial vehicles. From these vehicles have come extraordinary technological breakthroughs. The scientist, Robert Scott Lazar, said he had worked in the S-4 section of Area 51, a corner of the Nevada test site. There, he had read documents indicating the existence of ongoing research on an anti-gravity reactor for use in propulsion systems. He was astonished, he said, but he was even more shocked to be shown not one, not two, but nine flying discs of, quote, extraterrestrial origin, end quote, stored in the hangar. As part of the gravity harnessing propulsion, the craft used an element 115, unknown on Earth, because it is, quote, impossible to synthesize an element that heavy here on Earth. The substance has to come from a place where super heavy elements could have been produced naturally, end quote. From the recovered craft, the U.S. government had collected some 500 pounds of the stuff. Now, adding apparent credibility to Lazar's testimony were persistent reports, right, chronicled even in respected Aviation Week and Space Technology, of bizarre lights over the test site, craft maneuvering in ways beyond the capacity of known aviation technology. These reports are almost certainly genuine. Lazar's tales, on the other hand, are almost certainly bogus. Investigations raise serious questions about his reliability. His claims about his education and employment could not be verified. And his character proved to be questionable. If you recall, back in 1990, he was arrested for his involvement with the operation of a Nevada brothel. Well, listen, just because you want to look doesn't mean you lie. In 2003, element 115, a synthetic radioactive element, was discovered by Russian scientists. It was added to the periodic table in 2013. However, this element, also called muscovium, is not the same thing as the one Lazar claimed to have found. Lazar said his element could power alien spacecraft without worrying about gravity. So far, no use has been found for muscovium, which has a half-life of less than a second and thus decays very quickly. In 2019, a motherboard Vice Tech Channel published a lengthy article about Lazar. It detailed that the FBI and Michigan State Police had raided Lazar's scientific supply company in 2017 looking for thallium sulfate, which can be used as a poison and featured in someone's mysterious death. However, true believers think he was raided because they were looking for element 115. Reporter Tim McMillan asked Lazar directly whether he had a piece of 115. Quote, "If I had some, would I reveal it to confirm my accounts? Absolutely not," end quote, said Lazar. In 2020, the New York Times reported that an unidentified aerial phenomenon task force, which had been set up to investigate unidentified flying objects, was thought to have been disbanded, was still alive and well under the auspices of the Office of Naval Intelligence. The newspaper added that Luis Elizondo, who was the director of the task force until he resigned in 2017, believed that objects of undetermined origin had been retrieved for study by the Pentagon. So does that mean Lazar was right all along? Well, some people think so, but the program's main focus is not on looking for UFOs from outer space, but rather on, quote, discovering whether another nation, especially any potential adversary, is using breakout aviation technology that could threaten the United States, reported in the Times. So, kiddies, there's your background on Mr. Bob Lazar. Finally, folks, have Polka changed America? Polka, protege of Andrew Jackson and our 11th president, 1845 to 1849, changed America as much as or more than any other president. He did this by cementing the annexation of Texas, wrestling California and contiguous states away from Mexico, and bringing half of the Oregon Territory into America through a settlement with Great Britain. All of this was accompanied within a short term, single term, I'm sorry. Never before or since has there been as breathtaking a territorial expansion in the U.S. history. Polk was smart enough to see the great opportunity before him. One that his country would embrace. As Polk surveyed America in 1844, he saw a young nation experiencing growing pains and at the same time desperate to claim its place among leading nations. Nearly everything was in transition, and about the future. Economic developments that halted a market revolution were increasing class divisions between the newly and rich and poor, with little opportunity for upward mobility. Great waves of immigration from Europe were changing the country's ethnic profile, and xenophobia, then called nativism, was on the rise. Women had begun demanding recognition and power, undermining male authority at home and in public. Religious revivals emerging out of the Second Great Awakening gave birth to reform movements that dared insist society radically change. Working men were forming trade unions, and there were the hotly contested issues of slavery and temperance, so divisive that few dared truly engage in them. No wonder, then, that a shifting electorate, one whose electoral participation had expanded dramatically in the 1820s and 1830s to encompass virtually all white men, regarded the values and assumptions that had once defined the two political parties as less and less meaningful. In the midst of these shifts, Polk understood one core belief remained that could galvanize his party and unite the nation: manifest destiny. The push west could solve all of America's problems. It could provide the immigrant masses crowding American cities with land of their own to farm and a stake in society, as well as reinforce patriarchy by providing men with a means of supporting their families in an environment where strength and physical skill mattered. It would buttress American democracy by reducing the growing strength of manufacturing in the economy and the influence of the northeastern urban elite who profited from that system. And Alta California, on the far west coast, was home to harbors that might allow the United States to compete with Europe for control of trade with China. Expansion would make America strong. Quote, expansion was a winning political issue and the best policy for the country. But, and Polk believed, this in his very soul. It was also right. He saw clearly the long years during which cool heads had prevailed on Texas were over. There had been a quick romance, and Americans had fallen for Texas, even mythologizing the Alamo's dead. The American people were ready for annexation. Indeed, they believed, just what Polk did, that the United States was destined to expand and should take every opportunity to do so. Didn't everything in America's short history point to that conclusion? From the Puritan understanding of America as a city on a hill, a model to be replicated by others, to previous territorial acquisitions, the Louisiana Purchase of 1803, the purchase of Florida from Spain in 1819, the displacement of the five civilized tribes in the 1830s, and finally, the nation's incredible growth, population growth from 4 million to 17 million people between 1790 and 1840. are the nation's very character made expansion inevitable. America had a go-ahead, get-ahead nature with strains of ambition and individualism that led them to constantly push westward to and beyond the frontier. Polk instinctively grasped all of this. Expansion was a winning political issue, and once a promise of national glory and a symbol of dynamic change, still, he was not its standard bearer merely to sway voters. He truly believed that Americans were exceptional, that his country was marked for greatness. Manifest destiny was not a matter of if, but merely one of how, and it justified almost any tactic. The issue was, for him, a perfect marriage of politics and conviction. Tyler had done him the enormous favor of bringing the statehood of Texas into the mainstream, and now he would do the rest. Still, something else was at work in Polk's vision, something that held great appeal for the majority of Southern Democrats, for he was a slaveholder. Author Amy S. Greensburg, title A Wicked War, Polk, Clay, Lincoln in the 1846 U.S. Invasion of Mexico. Vintage Books, copyright 2012, pages 35 to 36 for your listening enjoyment on this glorious, glorious Monday evening. As we end every Monday, a few minutes of Tavern in Music. Kiddies, that about wraps up another edition of the award-winning, but yet to be nominated, This, That, and the Other, heard every Monday and Thursday here in Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com and your favorite internet browser. Head over to the website, kids. We are 100% listener supported. You can donate to us. You can become a Patreon. We have some donation options. If you got the gift for Gab, click on schedule. Find an open slot on Studio A or Studio B. Hit the contact tab. Send a message to the host review team. I want to be on the host review team. I want to be on some team. Thanks for listening, Pac. Otherwise, have yourself a fabulous, fabulous Monday. We will talk with you Thursday. In the words of Katie Couric, good night, y'all.
Revolution Radio every Wednesday 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.